Welcome to another episode of Racist Mindset here on the Big MX Podcast Network. I'm your host, Brad Gebhardt, and this episode is brought to you by Race Tech. With me on the line, my co-host, Andrew Hobson. Andrew, how's it going?
I'm doing great. Just off a big weekend of a bicycle charity ride for Ride for Rocky. He was a director at KTM and unfortunately passed away a few years ago. He was an avid cyclist and motorcyclist, so on his birthday, we have a bicycle ride, and there's a 20, 40, and 80-mile route. So that was great to see everyone. It was a free event. It was all done at KTM. Then we had a couple of guys that wanted to do 100 miles, so we made a 100-mile route. So I'm still recovering from the 100, but it's all good. But I will hand it back to you, and I'll let you introduce our host today.
Yes, our guest today here on Racer's Mindset, this being episode 8 of this series that I don't think we're going to be able to cap it. And in fact, I think we already have to have this gentleman on as a repeat offender for a repeat guest, but a guy who has a huge, huge impact on the Southern California motocross community. And since that's the mecca of motocross in general, his impact is spread out throughout the entire world. You've probably watched Bennett's War. You've seen, his bikes in the Motocross Action magazine. They're so easy to pick out because they got that big zero sort of that emblem right on the front. Pretty hard to miss. Talking about Tony Pantiera, better known as Pasha. Welcome to the podcast.
How you doing, man?
We're not doing too bad, my friend. How are you?
I appreciate it. It's awesome. Nice sunny day here in Southern California.
We have the opposite going on today. It is somewhere in the mid-50s and cloudy here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, which most people listening probably have no idea where that is unless you're from here. But all I can really say is we're 8 hours north of Millville, which is quite cold most of the year. We do get some hot days during the summertime, but nothing like California. Are we entering a time of year where it's like going out to Glen Helen actually might be almost a little bit more enjoyable because there's a lot less people out there in the heat these days?
You'd be surprised, Brad. It's Glen Helen is going to be 97 degrees this weekend. I was looking at, and you'd be surprised, man. A lot of people ride it, even when it's like 106, the gates are
just out there getting it.
Yeah, back when it was REM and Saturday Motocross at Glen, the people still come. The crazy guys still come.
Well, you have to be crazy to race motocross, period. And we could go in a lot of directions with this podcast, which is why you're going to be a repeat offender, whether the listeners like it or not. Let's spin the clocks back. Let's jump in the time machine to figure out where this story and the intersection of the world of motocross and Tony Pantiera, as well as Tony Pasha, as he's become known, where does that intersect? How far back does this go for you? Is that Twin Shocks and Indian Dunes and the whole nine yards? Or
No, well, I grew up in Northern California. I grew up in Northern California.
So okay.
Which was a shame. I mean, I loved it up there, but I wish I would have grew up with the SoCal motocross crew and I would have been somebody. But I missed that boat, you know? So I didn't do any of that. It was just Northern California free riding. I've always loved motorcycles as a child. I remember even as the earliest as I can remember, I loved motorcycles. So I just didn't have the opportunity to be involved with them like the luckier SoCal people did. So I didn't actually start professionally, or not even professionally, but like racing and sanctioned events and stuff like that till I was much older. So it's just the love and the passion of motorcycles, motorcycling, and everything with two wheels.
That is awesome. So you have developed an incredible network of people around you. One of the things that I think I can always sort of like, one of the greatest compliments I can have for you is just that your ability to network and put great people around you on your journey. Where does, like, how have you sort of developed that skill to be able to surround yourself with really positive people who want to see you be successful? And when you have these ideas to put on races, that I'd imagine that like no one does anything completely on their own. There needs to be a network behind them, sort of helping them promote things and get the word out, word of mouth. Like as much as the hard work that you put in, there's a lot of people who have probably gone to bat for you as well.
Yeah. Just like Hoppo right here. So my motto is always like, if you want to be something, don't act like it, just be it. Right? I tell my kids that, stuff like that. Like, if you want to be a singer, just sing. If you want to be a wrestler, start wrestling. If you want to ride dirt bikes, ride dirt bikes. Whatever you want to be, don't act like it and talk about it, be it. And then people will see it. When you're it, you're it. A rose is a rose. You're not going to look at a rose and think it's a banana, right? So be a biker. And I think I was lucky, because when I moved to Los Angeles from Northern California, I got into the Mecca of motocross in Glen Helen. And that's just by luck. I didn't like specifically move to California to ride Glen Helen. It just happened by chance, right? And I rode there religiously after LACR closed. And from being at Glen Helen, riding and racing as much as I do, and the crowd that hangs at Glen Helen, I guess slowly people noticed that I'm riding because I love it and the passion of it rather than for a reason. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I would go out there by myself and ride alone, even if I didn't know anybody out there. So then the network started, I guess, by people noticing that I really like riding. I really don't know, you know what I mean? I ride because I love it, and that's why, I guess.
Certainly. And then go ahead, Hoppo. What's your next question there?
I was just going to kind of back it up there a little bit to the point of where, you know, you lived in Northern California. You liked motorcycles. You eventually moved down to Southern California. At what age was that? And then when did the movies start to integrate to all that? Like, how did Pasha come down and go, I'm going to race motorcycles, I love it, but I'm also going to venture off into the movie set kind of career? And how did that all merge together?
Okay, what happened, Hoppo, is I was a kid back then when we moved down here, living with my parents still.
Okay.
And at that time, I had sold all my dirt bikes, and we had gone, it's kind of a sad story, because we had gone from 170-acre ranch that I rode on daily to an apartment in Los Angeles. It was because of my mom's cancer issue. So when San Francisco, UC Moffitt San Francisco said that we can't do anything else for you, you got to go to UCLA. UCLA is head of cancer research right now in the world. My father sold our ranch, and we moved to an apartment in Los Angeles so that my mom can continue to go to UCLA cancer research. So we sold the bikes, we sold everything, and we're stuck in an apartment. So basically at like, I think I was like 20, about 20 years old, something like that, 20, 21, no more motorcycle, in an apartment, no more 170-acre property. It was not nice. It was hellish. And I remember I got into the movie business because I was looking for work, and, I had no connections in Los Angeles. I knew nobody. I mean, it's not where I grew up. I grew up in Northern California. I grew up in the same town as Moseman, Josh Moseman, Josh and Mike Moseman.
Okay. Oh, they were here this weekend. Or yeah. Josh was.
Yeah, yes, he was. How did he do, by the way?
He went 12-11 for, I think, 12th overall. He could have been top 10, though. I literally watched him lose the front and go from 9th to 12th in the last moto. Yeah. He was up there. He looked good.
Yeah, people underestimate the Canadian tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Guys that I know that have gone to Canada, they say that the tracks are brutal, man.
Oh, yeah. They get beat up.
They're way more than SoCal, I think.
Sometimes, yeah. Well, we got some, like, deep, hard clay and, like, but they rip it deep first thing in the morning. So, yeah, the braking bumps get serious. And then Gopher Dunes is, for my money, maybe one of the most gnarly sand tracks in North America. So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we sold that property, you know, where Moseman's family's from. We're from the same small town. And then where was I? I had moved to LA and I was ready to kill myself.
You started in the movie industry because you're looking for work.
Oh yeah, I was looking for a job, guys. This is a, I don't know how much time we have on this podcast.
No. But all the time in the world, my friend.
I can talk for like weeks.
People like long podcasts.
I can talk till Saturday when I see Hoppo at the gate.
There you go.
So I was looking for a job and I saw this. Now you got to keep in mind, I knew absolutely nothing about the movie business. I'm a little redneck from Northern California ranch. Not knowing anything. All I saw was an ad that said $100 a day and free lunch. And what it was to do extra work in the background.
Nice.
I didn't know anything. I mean, I literally had no idea about the movie business. So I started, I said, hey, this is a great $100 a day when you're 20 years old in 1987. You know,
it's that's good money in 1987.
Oh, hell that's, yeah, like... that's a lot of money, man. And free food, too.
I mean, yeah, and lunch.
When you're like 20 years old, when you're 20 years old, you always think what you're going to eat next, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, shit, free lunch and $100. I'm going. So I called, and they're like, come sign up, this and that. I signed up, and it's like my first job. I remember I had to drive about 45 minutes to Long Beach, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. It was freezing. And they put me in this Roman skirt sandal outfit at the beach, and I was standing on the rock like a Roman guy waiting for a ship to come in, and I'm out there freezing, shaking. I'm like, what the heck? What is this? And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? They said, nothing. Just stand there with your sword and act like the ship is coming. So I'm like, well, this sucks. You know, what kind of job is this, right? And then at the end of the day, I signed the paperwork, and it was $30. And I'm like, wait, but the ad said $100. So it's sort of like, no, it's up to $100. It's $30. I'm like,
you've been bamboozled.
Yeah. So I'm like, wait a minute. So I went back and I called the people that I signed up, and I'm like, what's up with $30? They said, oh, no, it's up to $100. Most of the time, extra work at that day paid like 30, 50. You know what? It was the only income I had, and I did eat for free. So I kept going. Now, what kept me going was that, I had long black hair, my hair was like a couple of feet long down the middle of my back. And I was very fit. I've always been an athlete
Still very fit.
Yeah. Well,
very fit.
And I'm on a 125, Hoppo. You got that 500.
Yeah.
Air hammer. Boom, 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 boom. I'm on a
I got to do something to stay ahead of you at some point.
Yeah. So what kept me going in the movie business, and I figured I'd stay in it, is that every time I did extra work, whether it was two people in the background or 500 people in the background, the director always said, hey, you. And we're looking around. I'm like, me? He goes, yeah, like, come on over here. They always picked me out of the crowd, whether it was two people or 100 people. And they gave me what is called a bump. They would get me like a special extra, like the extra that's like you see better or standing next to the star or something. So, but they always picked me. And I always got like a $30, $50 bump. So I always said, oh, I must have a look for something, because they always keep picking me. And I kept going and I kept going and they kept picking me. And then my days became $150 days. And then they became $200 days, because I always got something special. Now, as an extra, this is where my life took the turn. As an extra, the lady who did my extra calling for me, her name was D, as in D-E-E. D said, they're looking for a guy that's 5'11", 165 pounds. And I was 5'11", 165, and very fit. They said, go to this address. They need to measure your body. And I'm like, well, okay, no problem. I didn't know anything. I'm still totally green. I have no idea how the movie business works or anything. So I go to this office in Van Nuys. And I walk in the door and I see all these creatures that I have grown up with in movies. Even the lagoon creature guy was there. You know, the lagoon, the lagoon animal looking thing.
Brad?
Yeah. The aliens guy was there. The predator Schwarzenegger's head thing was there. And I'm like, wow, this is a special effects place. Okay, cool. So the guys come out and they start measuring my body and my arm and legs and stuff. And they're like, oh, yeah, you're exactly the dimensions that we need. Do you have a few hours? I said, yeah, I'm here for that. So when they started measuring and molding my body, I became friends with the guys, and they clearly immediately realized that I'm a green guy that has no clue what he's doing or where he's at and stuff, like kind of like motocross was. And, it's exactly like how motocross started for me. So they took a liking to my, what do they call it? Naiveness. You know what I mean? I was just naive to all of it. I was young and stupid and naive. Like, so they took a liking to it. So basically what they started to do is they started molding my body with plaster. all the way to covering my head and eyes and everything. And they asked, hey, are you claustrophobic? I said, no. So they put a straw in my mouth and they started molding my head closed. And they said, you're going to be in this plaster until it gets hard. So just, if you get scared, just let us know. We'll rip it off. And I stood there like a champ and I did the whole thing. And in the process, they said, do you know where you are? I'm like, no. Do you know what you're molding yourself for? No. I didn't know anything. So make a very long story short, they said that you can ask for $1,000 for this mold because it cost us over $10,000 to make this mold. And they offered you $300. They said, go back to that lady and ask for $1,000 and they'll pay it because we're not going to redo this again. Blah, blah, blah. And then I said, okay, no problem. And what is this for? And what do you think it was for? What were they molding my body for, Brad? What do you think? Full body mold.
The mummy.
Good. Hey, I looked like the mummy, Hoppo. It was for the mold of the T-1000 liquid chrome for Terminator.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow, so cool.
Yeah. They said that, hey, this is a mold. This movie is Terminator 2. And I said, oh my God, Terminator 1 was one of my favorite movies. I had a crush on Linda Hamilton at that time.
You didn't.
Yeah, exactly. As a matter of fact, you know what, guys? Look that we're talking. I'm gonna show you something. Do you see the Linda Hamilton poster on the wall?
Yeah, sitting in the, I see it.
I see it, yeah.
Yeah, that's Linda Hamilton in the Jeep, in the famous picture that in Terminator 1, the guy is holding in his hand as he burns. Anyway, that poster was made by Lightstorm, which is James Cameron's, and it was a gift to me. Right. So anyway, I called the lady and I said, first of all, they told me to ask for $1,000 and not $300. And the lady goes, my God, they'll never hire you again. You only take what they offer you. I said, no, I'm telling you, D. They said, get $1,000. He goes, all right, I'm going to ask for $1,000. But if they don't hire you or fire you or whatever, it's not up to me. Like, okay. She asked for $1,000 and I got the $1,000 and she was shocked. And then she goes, was that your height, your body? I said, yeah. He goes, you ever been a stand-in? I'm like, I don't even know what that is. He says, let me see if I can get you in as a stand-in. So she made a call and she got me on set as a stand-in for Robert Patrick, which is the Terminator T-1000 character. And I was not a white guy with blonde hair and blue eyes and my skin tone was different. But the first day on the set, I guess just like the rest of my life, Slumdog Millionaire, I didn't belong there. And stand-ins are supposed to be almost identical to the actor because of height, color, movement, stuff like that. So I was the wrong color, and I had really long black hair. And the director of photography, Adam Greenberg at the time, he's a Polish guy with a heavy Polish accent, and he looks at James Cameron, and I'm wearing a leather jacket. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just wearing my regular leather jacket back in the 80s. And Greenberg yells out at James Cameron and says, hey, how am I going to light him? He's like five tones darker than Robert Patrick. So that was pretty much in the movie business. Now I've learned that pretty much means that's the last day you're going to work there because you're just not fit for the character.
Right.
And James Cameron had already noticed that I was the green guy that didn't like belong on the movie set. So he came to bat for me and he says, just light him lighter. I remember that. He says, just do it lighter. You know, he's dark, do it lighter. And that meant we're not going to get rid of him because I guess he had realized that I was like that green, like that naive about where I am and what I'm doing. And he took a liking to me. So all I knew is that this guy, I didn't even know what a director was. All I know is that this guy here, by the way, James Cameron's Canadian. Did you know that? Yeah. So this guy likes me and I realized that whatever his position is, everybody listens to him and everybody's scared of him. So I started hanging out and like standing next to him and like just being there because I was like that lost. Right. And him and I became very good friends and he totally took care of me. And about a week, I was driving a big monster truck to the set and James Cameron likes motocross and off-road things. Actually, James Cameron.
He's always wearing a motocross jersey. And yeah, always like an old one too. Like
a Fox one. Yeah.
He's always got like a Fox one or like a Thor one from like 02. I always love what like.
Yeah, it's a Fox one. So James Cameron likes everything motorsports. And I was driving a big monster truck that I had back from the ranch days, like a big old square body Chevy to the track. And I would to the set. And I would park it there, and James loved my truck, right? And then James Cameron also was one of the first producers with Kenny Alexander on Dana Dirt.
That's right.
Did you know that, Hoppo?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, James Cameron.
Yeah, that's why it was like Dana in the Dirt was sort of like it was a moto thing, but it was also a lot of movie sort of like connection to it. That's why when Troy Lee did the helmets, they had a lot of like almost like film tape and like kind of looked like it was like moto and Hollywood sort of kind of coming together. And of course, Kenny Alexander. And for those who are listening to this podcast and can't see that Pasha's got his Fast House jersey on. Kenny Alexander is basically the mind behind the look and the style of Fast House. They've brought on designers now that contribute, but the soul of Fast House and like the whole Indian Dunes thing from back in the day, that's all Kenny Alexander. He was there on day one.
Yeah. So the story continues as, Kenny Alexander, along with, James Cameron and, Jim Roberts.
Okay.
J.N. Roberts' son. Do you know him, Hoppo?
I know him, yeah. I have some other stunt guys that are in the business that I've met him through there as well. So yeah. I have met him.
So J.N.'s son, J.N. Roberts, the Desert Racer champ's son, Jimmy Roberts, Kenny Alexander, and James Cameron are the ones who started Dana Dirt.
Right.
Those are the three original amigos. And then Kenny Alexander, I don't know if the viewers know or not, is also an originally a stuntman. That's how I was trying to. Yeah. Kenny Alexander is a stuntman. Yeah. Kenny Alexander is known as being a stuntman originally in the movie business. And then that's how it all started. And then Dana Dirt was a one-day event that was only stunt guys and movie industry.
There's not the moto guys that have done stunt work like Dave Castillo and Regis Harrington, tons of those guys.
Or everybody. I mean, Harper, everybody. Stunt guys pretty much in Southern California.
The Wageman brothers.
Most stunt guys ride motocross.
Rich Taylor.
Even stunt women ride motocross.
Right. Tiana Falls.
Yeah, lot of stunt men and women ride motocross. So Dana Dirt originally was a stunt gig for the movie business, a one day event, which I was there the first time. I think it was 25 years ago, and then it became what it became right now. So me having the going back to the James Cameron Terminator thing. So at that time, I was not a stuntman. I was just a guy trying to hustle for a peanut in this world. And James Cameron knew that I was into motorsports because of my monster truck and our friendship with James. And one day, just by chance and accident, again, just like Slumdog Millionaire, man, everything in my life has happened by fate and destiny. Nothing that was ever planned. The original stunt double, Bobby Brown, was not called onto the set to do this scene by accident or something. The stunt coordinator, Joel Kramer, had not called him in. And the scene was, you guys ever seen that black Freightliner in Terminator hit the walls and then the roof gets chopped off by the bridge?
Right.
The big black Freightliner truck?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Jeff Dashnaw, that is a huge, tall, big guy, was driving that thing, and they needed somebody to double the T-1000 Terminator in it. So James Cameron pretty much threw me in that truck, and I'm in that truck hitting the walls and getting the roof chopped off and everything. And that right there not only got me the stunt credit, but it also put me in the Screen Actors Guild Union in 1988, 1989.
So I was going to ask. Yeah, I was going to ask that question. How you got your SAG card?
That's how I got my SAG card, Hoppo. Wow. It within a week or two of working on Terminator 2 as an extra.
That's cool.
But I had a athletic background of dirt bikes and off road trucks and racing and motocross and boxing and stuff like that. So I fit the bill, and then I met Joel Kramer. And by meeting Joel Kramer, I worked up the ladder slowly, becoming friends with the stunt guys and everything. And again, Slumdog Millionaire, Fate and Destiny had it that Terminator 2 was shot for like 9-10 months. So I had 9 and 10 months to become friends and become part of the clique. And after Terminator was over, I was so deep rooted into stunts, into the biggest movie ever made, that basically that one movie started as an extra. And by the time that movie ended, I was neck deep in the movie business in Hollywood, coming off of Terminator. And then coming off of Terminator is like, it's like throwing a guy who's never raced Supercross, makes top 10 in his first race ever out of pure talent. Like, no one knows him. He's on a clapped out bike and he comes in like eighth in Supercross. He's going to have a contract for his next race. And that's how it was with me and Terminator. Right after Terminator, man, it just rolled movie after movie. And that's how it started. And it was just because I was a kid from Northern California looking for a job as an extra. And I ended up there. And that's how the movie business came into play. I was not a dreamer. I was not an actor. None of that. I fell into it.
So with all that being said, which is an awesome story, obviously you're going back and forth to home. Your dad, did your dad say, Tony, come on, man, you've got to get a real job. Like, this is just shit. Like, come on, man, you can't keep, this is not sustainable.
Well, my whole life's been like that with my family.
a real job.
My dad, I mean, I'm the guy that would get arrested, you know, a couple times a night, cruising the boulevard, ditching cops, you know, racing cars. My dad used to tell my brother, don't grow up to be like Pasha. Don't be like that. Because he was constantly having to come and bail me out and get lawyers and stuff. Because I used to, like, race cars in the street and ditch cops. And, you know, back in the 80s, we did stuff.
You could get away with it then.
Yeah. No, you get shot. So that's how the movie thing, this big long story actually shortened quite a bit, is how I got into the movies, totally by accident. And then through the stunt community is how I met Jimmy Roberts, Kenny Alexander, Harpers, and then all of that family. And then we used to ride, Kenny Alexander used to rent LA County all the time, only for stunt guys. Right. And all the stunt guys would show up to LA County and we would all ride together. And I had become at that point, you know, a Hollywood stuntman. I was working all the time as a stuntman and I was riding with all my motocross buddies. And then one day I remember Kenny's had an idea of Day in the Dirt. And then, so that's how the movie business, stunt, Kenny into motocross. And now here we are. That's how it all started.
Okay. So I did, as usual, the night before, I usually go through everyone's Instagram profile and see how far they go back. And I mean, obviously you and I have been friends for a few years and had some great race battles, but I mean, I don't essentially really know you that deep, but I, you know, went through your profile and it's like, you know, you're similar to a Kent Reed where you have helped so many people over so long and given them chances, whether they've worked or they haven't. And again, I just want to say thanks for all that, helping all those people and, you know, doing, we'll go into the Pasha races and that sort of stuff as well. But, you know, from the bottom of my heart, it's a thank you because if it wasn't for guys like you, I wouldn't be racing two strokes at 53 years old on a 500 or wherever I go. I mean, I just drove 8 hours for a free entry to Utah last week. I mean, why wouldn't you drive 8 hours for a free entry? I mean, but again, for guys like you, you know, hats off and, you know, I love it. I just want to see more of it. So we'll progress in.
Yeah. I Pasha Racing is about it's quite old and it didn't start with motocross. Pasha Racing started with off-road truck racing and I was building off-road trucks and lifting Jeeps and big tires and suspension and stuff like that from my house back in the day. And I figured, what am I going to call it? I'll call it Pasha Racing. And then I just kept the name when it went from like monster truck building and off-road trucks to motocross. So before motocross, it was off-road trucks.
Okay.
Yeah. That's when I was like 22, 23, 24, just a kid building trucks for friends and whoever wanted me to build them a truck. At one point, I almost built a Hummer for James Cameron, but he ended up not doing it.
Are you still good friends?
You didn't want to have the same vehicle as Schwarzenegger or what?
What's that?
You didn't want to have the same vehicle as Schwarzenegger?
I don't know. I put together a program for him to build a bitch in Hummer, and then he just never did it.
No.
Yeah.
That's what happens in business, life, and everything. Things sort of slip through our fingers. Throughout your travels, I'm sure, whether it's like putting on events or hosting things, producing content, there's people who are all in and they're supportive of it. There's also going to be people who sling arrows and whether it's through jealousy or just insecurity or whatever it happens to be. How do you deal with some criticism that gets cast your way as well?
Well, that's a painful question because it's unfortunately very deep. I guess let me use this as a way to start this conversation. Ultimately, I was born Pasha, right? My name is Pasha. And my name, Tony Pantera, came about because of Hollywood. Okay. Yeah. So when I was trying to hustle Hollywood as Pasha, nothing was happening. And I could tell that it was basically racism. And I've had to deal with that my whole life. I don't know, Brad, you know I'm Middle Eastern, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that doesn't jive very well in the West, being Middle Eastern. Unfortunately, that's the truth. Maybe it's getting a little tiny bit better right now, but in other words, it's always getting worse too. So Pasha wasn't working in Hollywood. And, you know, a lot of actors that you know, are famous actors. That's not really their real name. Like Rock Hudson, you know, Rock Hudson and those guys, that's not their real name.
Stage name.
Yeah. So exactly. One way or another, we're all strippers. We need a stage name, Hoppo.
Oh, I love it.
So my stripper name, I always joke that my stripper name is Tony Pantera because I needed a name. And I figured I look like a Tony because I was doing a lot of Italian mob parts, like mafia parts, okay, with my jet black hair and my suits and everything. So, and then I was in automobiles, so I liked the Ford Pantera as a name. I don't like Fords. I'm a Chevy guy, but I liked the Ford Pantera. So I'm going to change my name to Tony Pantera. So Tony Pantera came because of Hollywood. And then unfortunately, guys, this is a fact, man. And I don't know if you ever felt it or not, Hoppo, in your life, because Hoppo, you're Australian or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you born in Australia?
Yeah, I was born.
Yeah.
I came here in 94.
Have you ever got any slack for being an Australian?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Really? I mean, it's
Crocodile.
Yeah, I get a lot of that, or, you know, throw a shrimp on the barbie, or, you know, all from, you know.
Why do you guys put shrimp on the barbecue? It seems like that's like.
Have you ever tried it?
Okay.
Brad, I get it a little bit here and there. I mean, I used to have the biggest phobia when I first came here because people would always ask where I was from, but. You know, when I worked for American Honda and we would all have meetings on Mondays and, you know, there'd be like 20 guys in there, you know, from all sorts of bosses or whatever. And I'd have to speak, you know, I'd always have a complex of my accent. And I think I shelled away from that for the longest time until like now. It's like, hey, let's do a podcast and let's be, you know, open on everything. So,
yeah.
And I took a lot of that, but over the time I do hear stuff like that. And, you know, and it's not until then, like you said, that it hits you and you go, wow, was that kind of what I thought it was? It's like, you know, but I'll just laugh it off. But still to this day, there'll be always some sort of Australian comment or something like that, which it's fine by me. It doesn't bother me. But again, you've seen it on a deeper level than what I have. So,
well, absolutely, man. So that's what I'm saying. Here you got Hoppo, big, tall, white guy. And here I am, a little brown guy. And then my name is weird too. At least his name is Andrew. My name is Pasha, which is even more guilty. And, so I would audition and I would never get the parts or anything. And, you know, Hollywood's run by, Jewish people. And when they found out that I was Middle Eastern, non-Jewish, blah, 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 I don't know if that's it or not, but I never got anything. But I will tell you guys this, man, as crazy as it sounds, as soon as I changed my name to Tony Pantera legally and I became Tony Pantera, I started booking things immediately. So what does that tell you?
Just because people thought you were the band?
Whatever. What, who cares?
Check. I was going to ask.
What do they call it? What do they call it? Placebo effect? As soon as I became Tony Pantera, I started booking jobs, commercials, everything, just by changing my name, because now I'm not Middle Eastern anymore to them, because I didn't look Middle Eastern from the beginning.
Right.
Which is why I was doing all the mafia mob roles and drug lords and things like that, but hitmen and things like that. But now that I changed it to Tony Pantera, boom, man. Just like Slumdog Millionaire, man. Everybody should watch Slumdog Millionaire.
I'm going to have to note that down and do that. You know, I didn't really have too much knowledge of the movie industry, but it wasn't until I was at American Honda and I worked with Goose, Mike Gosler, that his brother was Mark Paul Gosler. And then I was running the Factory Connection team at the time through American Honda. And we had Chris Gosler, who I seen the other day at Glen Helen. I hadn't seen him in 20 years.
Yeah, so did I.
And they did the Charlie's Angels, right? Then he got a SAG card and all this sort of stuff. And then all that was like, oh, wow, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. So that was quite a process. Not that I remember too much of it these days, but, you know, that was my first real interaction with, like, movie stars. And then, like I said, I didn't know who Mark Paul Gosler was. And then I'm all, oh, that was Screech off, you know, whatever that was. And it's like, oh. So there was, and then you would start to see in, you know, early 2000s, a lot of Supercross guys or, you know, movie guys starting to intertwine when they did those crossover series and that sort of stuff. So that was my first kind of real interaction to, like, that's a real guy. Like, that's not just someone I looked at a magazine that took 3 months to get to Australia or a TV show. You know, it was real.
So. Yeah, exactly. And then did you know, Small World, Hoppo? See, this is what I mean, Brad. It's all Slumdog Millionaire, man. Fate and destiny. Did you know Drew Gosler raced for me for 2 years?
Did not know that.
No, I went to Glen Helen. So that was the day you guys raced on the aero track. And then
I remember when Gosler was there.
Yeah. We raced, on the main track with the Arizona old timers. And then I seen Gosler and I'm all, Drew, and then Chris popped out, and like I said, I hadn't seen him for years, so it was cool to see him.
Yeah, Drew
Mammoth.
I helped Drew race for 2 years.
Okay.
When he thought he was going to come back.
What year was that?
Oh shit, I don't know, but it was a two-stroke. It was a long time.
Our paths must have crossed at some point in the early 2000s, there somewhere along the line.
Yeah, I wasn't.
We must have crossed somewhere along the line.
Well, we have to, because I was at Glen Helen in LA County, like, all the time. Hmm. Yeah, but like I said, I wasn't, it's really weird, man. I got a lot to say about motocross, man, and the people and everything. It's just, there's a lots of, like you said, you know, the haters and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Me being, well, in the movie business, how I had to change my name, to get the movies, that's obvious. And then, in motocross, it was kind of the same thing. I'm like the original, I'm the original black guy. Like, I'm James Stewart. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm the first Middle Eastern guy that broke above the line, I guess I could say. I don't know. What do you say? You know what I mean? There were no Middle Easterns racing motocross on this level before me. So I was like, even though people think James Stewart was the first black guy, he wasn't the first. Do you know who the first black guy in this, the first famous black guy in this industry was, Brad?
The reason why he is number two.
Hoppo probably knows. Hoppo, do you know who it is? You must know.
Andy Jefferson.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Man. I work with Andy.
Yes. I know that. That's why I didn't ask you, Hoppo. I knew, man, I knew you knew the answer.
Yeah. Huh? He was the first, and then he was also the first pro circuit sponsored rider.
Yes.
Well,
Andy Jefferson was the first. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up again, is because James Stewart was the first one that went social media and became a superstar, but people don't know that that wasn't the first guy. Maybe I'm wrong, but I believe I'm the first Middle Eastern guy that has broken into like American motocross on somewhat of a, you know, social media level. So a lot of, I got a lot of slack with that too. And also the fact that I wasn't fast. So I wasn't like a good rider at that time. I was just a fun freestyle rider, not a good rider. So I didn't have respect for being a good rider at that time either. And my name was Pasha, and it was just like the movie business, except I never changed my name in motocross. I stayed Pasha. So even until now, I deal with it, Hoppo. You know, a lot of people look at me with a crooked eye still.
I think that, you know, that, and it's tough, and I don't know why, because, you know, eventually we will get it out of this as well. It's like, but you got a guy that's given his heart and soul and hard-earned cash, which I think are the three biggest things ever, to either one, entertain people or make them better. So why should there be negativity out of that? I don't get it, you know.
Yeah, there is, man. There is. And then unlike guys like you that are close to me and friends and help and everything, there's a lot of people who praise it and then they do nothing.
Right.
So you've done a lot. I just want everybody to know Hoppo's helped me out quite a bit in some tight situations. He was able to get me things and connections and things that got me going, even for that one race or whatever. But there's a lot of people who praise it and do nothing about it and are capable to help, but they don't. And I just don't understand that as a psychology and not even motocross. If you like something and you're capable, why don't you do something about it?
Right.
You know? No, yeah, for sure. I think Hoppo is sort of overly modest when it comes to his impact and the way he's able to give back to the community. I think both of you are guilty of that. But I think that's sort of a trait that comes with the trait that makes someone want to give back to the community and feels like there is a call to action that, like, I'm enjoying this community. I love being around it. What can I do to make it a better place? I think both of you have done a great job of doing exactly that and continuing to do it and help each other sort of take things to the next level and pass sure. Through the 125 races and the two-stroke stuff, of which I think I'm going to be participating in short order. But what were you going to say there, Hoppo?
No, I just think that, you know, when you talk about that, the negativity, I'll just say negativity, I won't use any other words. But, you know, I guess I'd love to be in a position where Pasha is, where I could go and go, hey, Pasha, I'm going to drop so much cash in with you. Let's, you know, I don't want any, I just want to support it and see people race. But I think that, well, for me anyway, like you get the bad side of it. But at the end of the day, you go to Glen Helen, you promote the race, and there's going to be your circle of five guys. I mean, they're all going to be, you killed it today. You did the best job. Hey, we screwed up here. We could have done this. We could have done that to make it better. We'll work on it next year. But that tight-knit circle are your guys that they're the only guys that really matter anyway. Everyone else is just, well.
You know, yeah, absolutely.
That's how I see it. That's how you see it. But at the end of the day, you're doing something and you'll never be hated on someone doing more than you anyway. It's only the ones that are doing less.
Yes. Yeah, or do nothing. Yeah, I actually lost and separated from some close friends because of that. I had some friends that were pretty close to me that as I was rising the motocross ladder, they were more hateful and more condescending and more non-supportive because of jealousy or whatever, unfortunately.
Well, and it's just, you know, and it's action, right? That's all it is. Eric, we've spoke about this over our last series. It's like it's just thought and action.
Right.
Then the rest falls into place.
Right. And just like meeting guys like you, Oppo, I mean, you know, I consider you a big deal in the motocross foundation. You know, you're one of the footings. You know what I mean? And you helped me out a lot for what you could for what you can. And even your son helped me out quite a bit, man.
I mean, that was purely, I mean, I was in a position where I could, but I could see what you give to the industry. And it's like, why can't I give back? I mean, in terms of what you've done, it was only a small percentage, but it got you on the track. It got your guys that you helped racing. And at the end of the day, we're there to race, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, and nobody does that. That's what I'm trying to say. Even if you believe what you did was not that big, it was big because nobody even does that.
Right.
They don't even do that. So if everybody did that, can you imagine if everybody did that?
Yeah.
It'd be huge.
It would.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we can't always.
You get one out of 100 that wants to help. And then even this podcast, like you called me out of the blue and said, Brad wants to do a podcast. And I'm like, hey, shit, let's do it. You know what I mean? It's going to promote whatever we're trying to do. One of the things, Brad, I want you to know is that I don't sell anything, right? We don't have anything to sell. So I feel like, that character Lancelot in Knights in Shining Armor, Lancelot,
right?
King Arthur's number one fighter guy, Lancelot.
Yeah,
I feel like Lancelot because I have nothing to sell. And because I have nothing to sell and I have nothing to personally gain from this, what is the word? I feel invincible in going forward because no one can say anything because I have nothing to sell.
Nothing to lose.
No one can take it away.
You understand what I mean, Hoppo? Like, how do I explain that?
Well, it's the ultimate feeling of freedom in a lot of ways is that no one can really hurt me, going forward. And, but like you've done so much good within the industry, within the community, the 125 races, the two stroke stuff. I think you're going to be one of the first guys to ever host an all electric race. what's on the horizon for you?
Funny you say that.
That's dichotomy right there. That's mixing gas, hauling ass, and then, not a whole lot of gas. A lot of hauling ass. Get into some sort of what might be on the horizon for Pasha.
Well, I keep getting text messages from Varg that my $100 deposit Varg is ready. And I suddenly don't want it. I don't know, man. What do you think, Oppo?
I don't know. I mean, I guess we're all dating it. Well, I don't know about Brad, but I'm dating myself that, I was in an era in the early 90s. It was all two strokes. You know, I worked for Peyton and then there was a sniggle of a four stroke. And, you know, I remember the day he goes, I had to drive into the AMA meetings because he couldn't drive obviously. And then he's all, we're at AMA meeting. And he goes, you motherfuckers let this in. You're going to ruin the industry. Like, keep
who
it
said that?
Stroke.
Who said that?
Peyton.
Wow.
We're at an AMA meeting. He goes, you let it in. I said, you're going to ruin it. Anyway, I mean, that was about back in Troy, Ohio in like 95 or 96 or something. But, you know, now we have these electric bikes, which I'm not opposed to. I grew up in an era of two strokes. That's just me. But in terms of motorcycling, the future and everything else, I mean, there's no noise pollution. It's still not green. You still got to run a generator. You still got to plug in. You're still burning greenhouse gases and on.
I don't think anyone buying an electric bike is doing it for environmental reasons. They're doing it so that they can ride a backyard track and not make noise.
That's what I was leading to.
And that might be the only reason why a track doesn't get shut down, or that you can build a track in your backyard and that your neighbors don't bitch. What I find is interesting about the whole deal is everyone who gets one, I've ridden one. It was good, not great. Like it wasn't like this like whole like this epiphany of riding dirt bikes. Like this is now my world has now changed. Everyone who seems to own one though seems to think or their reaction is that like it's better than any four stroke, any two stroke that they could ever have thrown a leg over.
It's max torque at zero RPM.
Yeah,
right. That's the point,
guys. But it's also
you're gonna go through a lot of tires.
Yeah, but Brad, it's also this. It's also this. I think it's more this. I've ridden them too. And I like them and they're great, but it's also this. You know how every single person on earth, every bike rider, when they buy that new bike or the next bike, have you noticed how since 1970s, every bike you ever bought was better and better and better and better? And you're like, this is the best bike. Oh, I see you're off Yamaha on a Kawasaki. Oh my God, the 2022 Kawasaki is the best bike I've ever ridden. Then following year, oh, you bought a KTM. Oh my God, the 23 KTM is the best bike I ever rode, right? Every time a new bike is under you, whether it's a shitty bike or not, is the best bike you ever rode. That's what that is.
I think that when you look at, we've all ridden 450s. I choose not to ride a 450 because they're so damn good and too easy to ride. So I gravitate back to this 30-year-old machine. But, you know, when you really, and we spoke about this a while ago, Brad, where you look at technology now, where we've come from two strokes. Now, KTM reinvented two strokes with some electronic power valves and some fuel injections. They're still not quite there, but, you know, that could have probably been done 10 years ago. But then you look at this four-stroke engine and this engine and packages between all the manufacturers now, and it's like, what's left? We can go electronic suspension. We can go pneumatic valves. And we go seamless transmissions. We already know how good they are, how fast they are. You know, Pasha, you can follow a guy at Glen Helen, wherever you go on a 450, they can stop in the turn and dial it on, and then you'll never catch that guy at the next turn. I used to be able to hole shot my 500 against 450s 3 or 4 years ago. I can't do that now. So they're getting to the point now is like, how good is good and how do they make it better? Because they all have to keep progressing, right? That's life. We all progress.
Right.
What's left? Is it now that you got to bring this electric in that's all going to be on a iPhone and you can dial in whatever power curve you want? I seen an ad yesterday from a buddy of mine that owns a shop in Australia selling the Stark, and it was $16,000 for the 40 horsepower and it was $17,000 for the 60 horsepower. Now that's in Australian dollars, obviously. That's different economies, but it's like, what's next? I mean, I don't really know. I don't know.
Well, Formula One has all those suspension upgrades and things like that. You can follow that to dirt bikes. I thought about all those things. Like you can have that electric magnetic whatever bullshit suspension or all of that. Yeah, but it, the human body is already not capable of a 450 that was built 10 years ago. Like, where are we going? That's why so many people are getting hurt, man. It's because we are overdoing what a body can handle. Many, I might be a nobody saying that, but many top guys have said, you know, no one needs a 450 because it'll kill you. It's just too much power, too heavy. And you know, a guy like me or anybody can say that and be like, oh man, you're just a, you know, a pussy or whatever. But no, man, it's too much power. It's dangerous. Like people get hurt. When Brad, how old are you? You're not that old, Brad.
35.
Yeah. See, I'm well over 20 years older than you.
Yeah.
When Popo back in the day, when we were racing 125s and 250s, did you hear of one crash that the guy broke 7 bones and was in a coma?
Yeah, those injuries didn't happen in the
almost never.
The like very infrequently.
No, never.
70s, 80s, 90s.
Those injuries happen if you got into a car accident.
Well, and also like the bikes evolved to let us go faster, jump higher, jump further, and then the tracks evolved to have the obstacles that will send you that far, that like the tracks now challenge the bikes almost as much as as to their limit. And that just keeps getting higher. So the risks keep going up.
It's not necessary, man. Yeah. That's why I'm not a Supercross fan at all. And when I say that, people are going to be again, because you're a sissy, you can't ride it. You this. No, it's not, dude. Like, I remember I had a rider, Brock Shoemaker. And Shoemaker went to Supercross Anaheim, and I think I don't know the exact. I don't remember because I've done so much stuff that I don't remember all of it. But I'm just gonna package it up in the statement that he cased the triple, and he either broke both legs or both wrists in one triple.
Yeah, it was both wrists, I believe.
Is that both wrists?
Yeah.
So Hoppo, all year we built this bike, spent tons of money, went to Anaheim, and in one jump, he was out for the year.
Yeah. I mean, I owned two teams in Australia, a Honda team and a Cowie team. And I had a similar instance, kid from Tasmania, the same thing. We built these bikes. We got engines from Peyton. We did everything. We go and break them in at Supercross track, miscues, breaks both wrists, done.
And you were like,
And that's just the vitality of the sport, right? That's the chance we all take.
Yeah. But Hoppo, 25 years ago, when did a guy jump a triple and break both wrists? Almost never.
Right. Well, go back and look at like Ramsey in 2000 winning a championship, 2001, and all the 125s always jumping front wheel high, right? Because they never had the power to get over everything, but now we've progressed. I mean, I could state you horsepower each year all the way up until, you know, what each bike really had, and then the tracks have changed and everything else. So,
yeah, so I'm not a Supercross fan because I think all they're trying to do is make a show for the people rather than a track and a race for the riders. I don't like all the flashing lights and smoke and fireworks. And I know it sounds crazy, huh? I think Supercross is disrespectful to motocross. Isn't that crazy? Like, you don't need all that. It's all about selling tickets and people want to see the crashes and somebody, you know, like, I'm just not a Supercross fan. I'm an outdoor guy.
Yeah. I mean, it is a show and it is a business.
Yeah, it's a show and a business.
Exactly. Like, honestly, we can go into a ton of things here with this, but like, and with Supercross and like Feld and MX Sports now working together, I can't imagine that when it comes to like the Super Motocross series, like, The Supercross people they've got to like go to an outdoor national event, and I don't know if they love everything about it, if that makes sense. That like it's their most tracks, like, okay, where is Unadilla is in New Berlin, New York, close to nothing. The only tracks that are really close to like sort of city centers, Paula is close to San Diego, Lakewood, Colorado is close to, but not really that close to Denver. It's like an hour and a bit. Millville is in the middle of nowhere. Southwick, Massachusetts, it's a small state. You can fly into Boston, but it's still not that close. When it comes to marketing it, and like, it's like completely the opposite of what Supercross is. Supercross is big jumps, tight corners. The whole show is 3 hours long. It's in a stadium. Everything's clean. Everything's sterile. With moto, like, you can have rain. You could not have rain. You have all these different, like, the different landscapes, different soil, different everything. And you can't really get that close to it. It's funny. Like, nowadays, you watch, like, the way – I'm sure it's all because of liability reasons in the States. But, like, you watch a race from, like, 1985 – and it feels like you could, like, the fans could like high five the riders or like grab their jersey while they're rolling by. Whereas now you can get closer to a race as a, at a national than you can for Supercross because of the way the stadium's built. But like, you're not really that close to a lot of the action. In fact, say if you're at Redbud, which again, Buchanan Mission is close to nothing. You're flying into Chicago and then driving 4 hours. It's really quite interesting to sort of see the sort of the dynamic of what makes an outdoor national. And if you're standing on one side of Redbud, if you want to sit on, like, say, like you're watching the leap, like that's about maybe 10 seconds of the track, 20 seconds at best. The rest of the track is on the other side of the hill. You can't see a damn thing.
Right. That's the same with Mount Morris.
Yeah. Mount Morris, same way. Washougal. Like, if you post yourself up in one spot, you'll watch the same obstacle all day long.
Elsinore was like that.
Elsinore was like that too. Glen Helen's kind of nice. You can see the whole thing. I was in Ernée for the Motocross Nations. That's a track. You're not anywhere close to the track because it's basically built like almost like a bowl. Like all the fans are on one side and then the track is on another. So from a distance, you can watch the entire track. But standing next to the track, there's certain areas you're not going to see. So that actually, like, that, those aspects of it must drive the Feld Entertainment people nuts.
Yeah, those are the things that you have to deal with real motocross, though. That's why Supercross has become like a sporting event like baseball. like football, like, you know, like going to a stadium, everybody sits around, you have chairs, there's no dust, there's no dirt, you're not walking back and forth on a dirt track.
I'd be surprised if the mechanics even
oil the air filter. It's like a movie. Supercross is like a movie. You get your popcorn, you get your drink, you go sit down, and you watch this movie that's called Supercross. And then you get up, and you get in your car, and you leave, right? Outdoor National, you go as a spectator. By the end of the day, your ankles or knees are throbbing because you walk 900 miles.
Yeah, you put in your 10,000 steps trying to watch from every vantage point.
Right, right. And I'm just not a Supercross fan, maybe because I'm an old, washed up dude, but I'm just not a Supercross fan. Plus losing Brock Shoemaker in one jump was not, you know, a cool thing. It was sad, because it was sad for him too. You know, he broke both wrists, and that was the end of that season.
I remember the name.
Yeah,
Brock Shoemaker. He was a long time. He worked with like Team Skivvy. He was on there with this Colin Morrison's team for a little bit there. Put it into a lot of night shows. Some main events as well. Super talented on a dirt bike.
That was one of hundreds of people that helped, man. But so anyway, that's what I think about that, and then. And then my brain is blanking right now, so I'm about to, I'm swapping right now.
So, what's your next project? What's Pasha got on the list? What's next?
Well, Hoffel, I want a title sponsor, man. I want my series to blow up, and I want it to be huge. Oh yeah, this is what I was going to say. Also, the sport of motocross is such a money making machine with those heads of people that make all the money, that they're taking advantage of the riders. The riders need to make more money. This is an extremely dangerous sport, and it's very, very limited in income, because you can only make money maybe 20 years maximum.
Oh, 20 years if you're absolutely, if you're
that's
lucky.
That's what I'm saying, maximum. So I believe person, what, Hoppo?
I was just about saying, without even the forecast of being injured or being hurt for the rest of your life. Yeah. But they choose to do that. So
that's not fair to say that. But yeah, we choose to do that, and people come and you make money off of it, right? So in my opinion, the last qualifying LCQ guy, the guy who got dead last in a main, should make enough money to live a comfortable life.
Right.
Because
he should, it's one of those things where they haven't organized themselves to say, hey, like, we're gonna have an association or a collective bargaining thing. We're not gonna race unless we're gonna get paid this much. And
now we're talking like communists.
Well, I don't know if I'm talking about communists, but it's just...
No, I'm joking. That'd be like a union, like a motocross union.
Yeah, a union. And there's riders' unions in other sports, or hockey has their, like the NHL Players Association, or anything quite like that. And at one point, they all had to, they've had like lockouts, and they've had seasons where they had, I don't think the NHL ever had like replacement players, but even in the NFL in the mid-80s, they had replacement players, and they like, guys wouldn't cross the line, and for that reason guys get paid for what they do now. The thing is with motocross, and this is at every level of the industry, like one of the main reasons why motocross photographers bitch is that there isn't a lot of money. Well, for every good amazing videographer photographer that wants to work in the industry and get money for it, there's always every single year there's 10, 20 new kids that they just want to be close to the races. They don't care if they get paid, and they've got a nice camera and they know how to use it. They're savvy on, like Premiere Pro or whatever it happens to be. And, they're willing to work for free. And if someone's willing to work for free, that's going to drive the price down. Same thing with, there's guys that are like, I don't care if I get paid. I just want to make a main event. For as long as that attitude exists, you're going to have guys that don't get paid. So
exactly. So maybe Hoppo and I will start a union right now and really be hated.
Oh God.
I mean, like we had a conversation. I can't remember when it was, Pasha, but I mean, you know, your your comment to me, if I remember it correctly, was I want to give back to the racing where it was in the 80s and 90s, where there was pro purses, they were paid back to 10th place, and like what you touched on, everyone walked out of there with some cash in their pocket. And, you know, and I knew that come from your heart to do that, but we all know that, you know, like you said, it's a very expensive amount. I mean, you're looking at 20 grand now, right? Go buy a bike, all new gear, get to the truck before you even throw a leg over, pretty much. If you pay retail for everything.
Oh yeah, and if you bought everything new, like the entrance to the sport is minimum $20,000. As long as you started with a pickup truck that can pull everything.
Yeah, but do you know how many kids I know that broke young kids that are fast that I know that their 4-stroke engines blow up, and then they just don't have the money to rebuild it, so their career goes down the shit over one.
Well, that, you know, when we talk about that AMA rule with the 4-strokes, I mean, that was what the manufacturers seen, right? Because they had 4-stroke engines in all the road models, and they're all, hey, we got an extra 200 moving parts here. We can make an extra 30% on all those parts. So next minute, that little 250cc 4-stroke engine just compounded in terms of profit. And
yes.
They were kind of at the end of, I don't think the technology was there at the end of the 90s for, you know, fuel injection and that sort of stuff to make 2-strokes better.
But it's killing motocross, man.
Yeah. Well, I remember.
Makes gas all ass, baby.
You know, at the end of the 90s, and I was still at PC before I went to Honda, and then Ricky won that championship in 97. That bike's still in the front room. There was only two things on that bike you could not buy. That was the Works KHI piston that was in it, and the mag covers. Everything else was available over the counter. We've also progressed 25 years from there as well. So, you know, as is everything.
Yeah. So I don't want to sound like a hater against 4-strokes or whatever, but I don't know, man. And then, like Hoppo said, the kid's not making any money. At some point, it's ridiculous to think that my stupid fun events pay more than some AMA events to the winners and to the second, third, fourth, and fifth place.
Right.
And how are they supposed to drive and live and go race and do all that with that income, which is almost nothing?
Right.
You know what I mean?
I think the days are gone of a guy, a local pro, being able to turn up in the back of his pickup truck and qualify for a national or a supercross. Those days are done. I mean, you need an army around you now, I believe.
And that is sad. And that is sad. That is sad because not everybody, see, I didn't have, you know, the opportunity to be the guy even in the privateer truck going to the track. I didn't have that opportunity growing up. And now I can see that even if you have the opportunity to be the guy that to go to the track, you're never going to make it again because now you need a village behind you.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So now it's even harder and you need more and more money and more everything. And it doesn't need to be like that. So the proof is in the pudding of how much people are enjoying and loving these 2-stroke races and the success of it and how much people love it is already proof that we're on the right track. We just need greater help from like a title sponsor to keep this thing going, you know?
Right.
For example, electric bikes are never going to disappear and they're only going to grow, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Well, they're going to grow, but why
the major manufacturers going to make one and push the guys who are currently making them? Like, I don't want to poo-poo on Stark whatsoever, but once Honda figures it out, they've already had it figured out, the racing one, but once they bring that thing to market and Yamaha has one and Kawasaki's probably going to have one, I assume they're going to have one, KTM guaranteed they're going to have one, the infrastructure and the money that those companies can throw at projects like that, it'll like these smaller companies will suffer big time.
Yeah, and Suzuki will have one too, but it'll be the only electric bike with a Kickstarter.
I don't see that coming.
You don't turn the key to turn the Suzuki on. You have to kick it, and that's
how the battery.
It would be solar powered, and it would suck.
I'd heard a quote yesterday, and don't quote me on. And it was only in passing that I believe MotoGP and F1 in 2028 or 29 have to go to a biofuel or like a hydrogen fuel. Like they're pulling out, you know, gasoline to an extent. It's got to be a biofuel.
I don't like this.
Yeah, but why? Why, Hoppo?
I got no idea. Like I said, I'm the messenger. I just overheard a conversation that, you know, the rules are changing and who knows? I have no idea.
So, who are these people making these rules, man?
I don't know. I mean, I guess they've got to. I guess they got to have rules to change direction to make. I don't know. I can't answer it.
The people that are making these rules, did they ever race once? My God, man, are they real? Are they real drivers? Are they real racers? Who are these people?
I don't know the people of the governing bodies to answer that.
Our little fun race is where your regular pickup truck guy comes and gets money all the way, sometimes to 10th, sometimes to 5th. And the whole atmosphere, the whole day. You've been there, Hoppo, didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you did my races, man. Are they?
I haven't raced that much this year, but last year I did nearly all of them.
Yeah, but wasn't that fun, man?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. It was killer. It was fun. So I'm hoping with the publicity and everything that we get, that some title sponsor gets interested and so on, and I can run like a series all year for money for the riders. I don't want to make money. I just want it to run itself.
Right.
So that, you know, business is kind of slow right now in America. Things are a little bit sketchy out here.
Yeah.
So making money to give it away like that is a little bit harder than normal right now. So now would be the best time for someone to jump in. And from the beginning of all this, Brad, what I want the people to know, and it's 100% fact, is that none of this would be possible. None of it, anything I've accomplished would be possible if it wasn't for Jody Weisel and Motocross Action. If I didn't have Jody Weisel, Jody Weisel is the second James Cameron. So James Cameron was the guy in the movies and Jody Weisel is the guy in motocross for me. So absolutely. It wasn't for his noticing of my passion and love for motocross and the kind of person that he is, who is a true motocross guy. I would not be able to be catapulted into this kind of where I am right now. So I have to thank and put the dues on Jody and Motocross Action.
That's right.
That's 90% of the fuel, right, Hoppo?
Oh, for sure. And to vouch that, I mean, I know Jody has his lovers and haters and everyone else, but, you know, back in 94, when I came here 30 years ago, I had two gear bags. One had clothes and one had rod gear. And I started working for Peyton.
Which one smelt better?
Oh, I think the gear bag was bad. This is the story I'm leading into as then, you know, same thing. I get here fresh off the boat. I was like, all these people are in magazines. And next minute, I'm with them. I'm at Carlsbad with Jody and the crew. Larry Brooks is test riding and all these guys. And I drag out this gear and I had to go ride this Yamaha that I built a pipe for. And Jody just pulled me aside and he said, here's my address. Come to my house this afternoon. And I went there and he just opened up the garage and says, throw that shit away. And then he loaded me up with two gear bags full of gear. And from that day on, I've always been thankful for that guy because he just, same thing. He just give back. I mean, yeah, it was all samples. It was from Fox. It was from whatever it was. But that day changed when he gave me from head to toe, two or three sets of everything. Just like that. Didn't even bat an eyelid.
So that being said, I respect and love Jody because not only because he's helping me, because of the kind of person that he is, because he's a very, very, he's like the, if this was mafia, he would be the leader, right? He'd be the kingpin. Right. the Kingpin guy, but he still shows up to the track. And if you don't know him, that white truck that they drive to the track looks like it's going to break down anytime. And he's walking around like people would be like, you know what I mean? There's no show off. There's no nothing. That's just Jody. And that's a real back of a privateer kind of truck racer kind of guy, right? Still wearing high point boots and stuff like that. And yeah, it would be shocking to look at him and then say that that's one of the most powerful guys in motocross. And he took a liking to me, I guess, because of my passion and stuff like that. And so 90-95% of what's happening here is because of Jody and Motocross Action and their support. And I'm just hoping that a title sponsor will want to take advantage of that publicity that I get, because like I said, I got nothing to sell, man. So hopefully somebody can hear this podcast and be like, let's do something.
Let's do something. I love it. Finish off the podcast. We ask the same four questions to each of our guests to sort of get a baseline. Some commonalities will come in, some won't. So Pasha, what is something that you did that you wish you did more of last year?
The race, man. I wish I could hold more races. I'd like to hold a race once a month, 12 round series, with money, with big money. I want it to be huge money. I've always had a flamboyant personality, and I want it to be huge money. I want it to be like $10,000 a race, not for the whole race. I mean, $10,000 a class. So if I have $30,000 for each event, it would be $10,000 a class. And Hoppo himself will make a ton of money because he's one fast dude.
Oh, I'll be professional so quick.
That's what Kurt Nichols said. Kurt Nichols said, if you can get this thing going, I'll quit and I'll just race for a living again.
Brad will make some money.
I was going to say, I'll dust off the KX125. Actually, it's not even dusty. And we'll head down there. But yeah.
I have something unfortunate to tell you.
Oh, it's
your KX125 will not stay with what's happening right now. You need a modern 150, 125.
Oh yeah, that thing's pretty. It was pretty gutless in 04. I can only imagine now lining up against the current crop. Off air, we made note that you're not an avid reader. But what is a lesson that you've learned recently that you've been able to put into practice and sort of level up with?
You mean in motocross or in life?
Just life.
In life.
I believe in life, man. Just like I said, just stick to what you know is right, even if it feels wrong at the time. And just stick to what you know is right. Integrity, moral business conduct, integrity. Even do the right thing, even when no one's watching.
That's good. I like that. Yeah. Especially doing the work when no one's going, the cameras aren't on or there isn't the people around you. That is exactly, that's essentially how you get the measurement of a man or a woman in that matter.
Right. Right. When I'm dead, I want to die. Like, okay. I'm laying there my last few breaths. I'd be like, okay, I did everything that I could. I did it right. And I got no regrets. And, see you guys later.
See you later. I like it. What project do you have coming up next? What is the most like, what's making you feel the pressure right now?
Right now, the pressure is the economy, because I want to have another race immediately, long before World Vet shows up. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to hustle business right now and trying to do everything that I can to put together something where we can have at least two more money races before World Vet. Yeah, I'm doing this like with minimal friend, with minimal help from some very close friends. But, in order to come up with $15,000, $20,000 or $30,000 that you can give away, that's no joke.
No doubt. Yeah. And to be able to put that in the genes of racers is important. Who has been your greatest mentor or someone who's helped you the most lately?
Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, but the only guy would be Jody, man. I mean, Jody's the only one that keeps it going without his support. I mean, how can I, go forward if they're not supporting? By the way, my bike's on the cover of July Motocross Action. Did you see
it? I saw that. Yeah, the Fantic.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. We haven't touched on the Fantic.
Yeah, touch on the Fantic, Brad. You're trying to get off this podcast already.
No. I told you we can talk for a week. How did you get the Fantic over here?
The people are posting that it's bullshit, this, that. It's not bullshit, man. We broke the bikes down, put it in boxes, didn't ship the wheels so it passes as parts, and we brought it into America through customs, taking the chance that it might be taken away. And we risked the money. That's a fact.
Yeah.
It's not a Yamaha with a Fantic kit. Those bikes came from Europe in boxes and had to be assembled.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one amazing. We kept bone stock, and one we built to the hilt.
There you go.
And if anybody watching wants to buy, they're both for sale.
And they're both for sale. Fair enough.
Because okay. They got to fund the next race.
Yeah, they're both for sale. The stock Fantic is for sale, and the race Fantic is for sale. So if anybody wants to buy a Fantic in America, we have two of them for sale.
Who did the motor on the Fantic?
We do. I'm glad you asked, my man, because now I'm building race bikes in-house.
Okay.
And because of the success of my bikes being raced by top pros and winning everything.
Yeah. Guys like Brian Madero are
bringing me bikes to build. And I'm building them in-house with my friend and fellow racer, Chris Heinrich. Me and Chris together are building these bikes in-house. And the last, Hoppo, did you know that Lapanovich's 150 that Harper built was my build?
Yeah, I knew that.
I'm building bikes now. So people are bringing me bikes to build for them because of the success of my winning bikes. And my winning bikes have now been my bikes. But before that, the most winning bike was Mike Brown's bike, which was Twist Development.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then Hassaker and Varner's bike have also won many, many championships. But now I'm building them in-house. We've had quite a few customers. We're building a Yamaha right now for somebody after the success of Fantic, actually.
So probably one last question here. You mentioned that you're not really a book reader or an audio guy, but you have made a lot of reference to the Shoe Dog Night. What was the part of the Shoe Dog Night that really resonated?
Slumdog Millionaire.
Slumdog Millionaire. That's it. Yeah, I mixed them all up, didn't I?
You did.
Yeah. Slumdog Millionaire. Once you watch Slumdog Millionaire, Hoppo, it'll make sense to you because it's a guy that just floats through life like Forrest Gump with a feather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you focus on everything that happens to you in life, all the answers are there, man. There's no... If it's black, it's white. If it's up, it's down. Everything's happens all then and there. You just have to be ready for the bus.
Okay.
You know?
Awesome.
I like it.
Yeah. So what else, guys? What did we not cover? What else? Hoppe, what else, man?
No, that's about it. I've pretty much nodded through all my questions. I think I would say something maybe – maybe we could do a live interview at Weld Vet because Brad is going to come down and race.
Oh wow, Brad, are you coming? Brad, you coming?
That's right. Yeah, no, I'm 35. I've been eligible for this race for 5 years now. I haven't been able to make it happen. But if I'm not mistaken, it's the November 6th weekend.
First weekend of November.
Yeah, so that's my birthday, and for my 36th birthday, I'm giving myself. Do they have a plus 35?
Plus everything. They have a year. They have every single year, 31, 32. I'm kidding, but they have a lot of years. So you're a Scorpio, Brad.
Yes, sir.
And so am I.
Yeah.
Right, what are you, Hoppo?
Pisces.
Oh, no, dude. Pisces and Scorpio are best friends, man.
Yeah. So maybe we could do we'll see how the rest of the year goes. I'd like to organize some live podcasts at Glen Helen for the World Vet. I think would be kind of cool.
Brad, why don't you bring the bike, dude? Are you going to race?
Well, hey, guess who owns my old 300? I sold it to Brad.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring it back.
That thing is not old and it's extremely fast, dude.
Stop. All it
you
was
don't
was
have to tell me.
But I can tell you right now, Pasha, I have a new one in the works. And it is carbureted and it is electric start. So I'll be seeing you shortly.
Oh, wait. Carbureted electric start. So that's
I'll leave it there. We'll leave it at that note.
Or was it Gene Bohr? Somebody said that you're turning the carburetor bikes into electric start bikes and you have the case and all that.
That could be along the lines. Maybe. Oh. We'll see. We'll see. Man.
You know I have a nasty 300, right?
I know.
I have a nasty, nasty 300, man.
I've felt it before. I've seen it.
Yeah, my 300, Brad, my 300 is so fast that at Day in the Dirt, I passed a rider on a RM250 in my class. And guess I passed him twice. I passed him, he passed me back. I passed him again, and then he passed me back. And then I finished on his rear wheel. Guess who that rider was, Brad?
Who's that?
Damon Huffman.
Damon Huffman?
Yes, sir. That's
a legend. Right.
Yes. He was I took classes from him 25 years ago.
He's there probably wishing he didn't teach you so well.
I passed him. He passed me back. I didn't know it was Damon Huffman. I didn't know it was him. I just thought it was a guy on a Suzuki. If I knew it was him, I probably wouldn't have busted a move. But that goes to tell you that it's all in your mind, dude. Because I didn't know it was him, I busted a move and I passed him, and then he passed me back, and then I passed him again, and then he passed me back. And then suddenly after I passed him twice, maybe he saw my name on the back of the jersey, he just suddenly became a better rider. Like, it was weird.
Yeah, I'm not going to let that happen.
Yeah, and then at the end of the race, everybody was praising, oh, my God, this, that, you did great, you did so good, whatever. And then he goes, and then one of the guys says, you even passed Damon Huffman. I said, what? He goes, what do you mean, what? He passed him twice. I said, what, who? The guy on the Suzuki. I said, no way, dude, that was Damon Huffman? Holy shit. And then, of course, the race is over, so I'm much faster after the race in my head. I'm like, man,
we're always faster again.
Hey, the older I get, the faster I was, right?
Oh, yeah.
But my 300 is fast, man. I want you to ride it. Hoppo, just check it out.
Yeah. So, awesome. Well, once again, can't appreciate for everything you do for the motorcycle industry. And I hope that we can really make something and get your dream up and running. I don't know how or when we can do it, but hopefully we can work on something.
Yeah, well, we're going to keep going with support with guys like you, Hoppo, and stuff like this, podcast, Brad, social media, stuff like that. Hopefully, you know, we're just building something. You know what I mean?
Right.
It takes one step at a time. And are you going to go to Redbud at all, Hoppo?
No.
Okay, because for the first time ever, me and the four amigos that helped me with Pasha Racing, Nick Mayrose, Chris Heinrich, we bought tickets. We're going to go to Redbud.
Oh, nice.
Right on.
It's a great track. It's an awesome track.
We've never been there. Just like Brad said, we're going to fly into Michigan, and we're going to rent a car. And you know how that came about, Hoppo? Mm-mm. I was getting messages from Europe, from Germany, Belgium, Italy. Guys were messaging me on Instagram and stuff like that, am I going to Redbud? And I said, no, I'm not. And they said that they are going to Redbud from Europe and they would love to meet me in person. And I'm like, okay. A lot of people say that. I'm like, fine. And then I thought to myself, well, shit, it can't be that big of a deal to go to Redbud. I called up a couple of guys who helped me out, Nick and Chris, and they're all for it. So we just got a round trip ticket. We're going to be there one night. We got a rental car. And Chris used to race Redbud, and right. Chris himself has actually jumped that Loracos leaf thing on a 252 stroke before, but I've never been there. So we're going to Redbud. I'm excited about that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great track. It's a great place to be. I would love to race it. I think actually, if I want to go to Loretta's one day, that'll end up probably being my, the location qualifier. For the qualifier for my regional, but. We got to get there first. But, Pasha, Brad, this has been an awesome time. Awesome. I appreciate you making some time for us today.
Yeah, right on, my man. Thanks for having me. Thanks for Hoppo. And I don't belong anywhere near this established guy called Hoppo. But I don't know Slumdog.
No. Hey, I'm not getting messages from Europe to go to Redbud. So you've got.
Yeah.
I'm way.
You're an icon.
On a lower level than Hoppo, man. I don't have his history. I don't belong on the same table, but this is my life.
Oh, come on.
Come on, Hoppo.
Awesome, all right.
Guys. Well, you have yourself a great rest of your day. Don't hang up just yet, but for podcast sake, we're going to cut things off.
All right, guys.
Right there.
Welcome to Best 42 in the land. All ages from kids up to grown men. Walk through the gates of the coal miner's daughter to make a point clearer than the creek water. Who's the best? Who's it gonna be? In Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. Can you feel the adrenaline? Dirt flies hypnotized by the wind spin. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Times. This 1 week of racing could change your life. Everybody knows this is where it all begins. Do what you gotta do for 20 plus 2 out at the ranch. Golf carts, pit bikes, and rowdy fans. Play the national anthem and everybody stands. Smell the smoke from the two strokes riding by. The 30-second card's on its side.
It's time to get
out. Can you feel the adrenaline? Dirt flies hypnotized by the wheel spin. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Line on the field. If you can put it all together three times. This 1 week of racing could change your life. Everybody knows this is where it all begins. Do what you gotta do.